Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer and artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field. Today's guest is Michael Z. Williamson, an author who writes military science fiction and military fiction, and who is best known for his libertarian-themed Freehold series, exploring military and political themes, as well as first contact with alien beings. We met originally at LostCon, I guess in the early 2000s, and later at DragonCon, and make it a point to see each other every year at DragonCon. I think of him as a survivalist, and from that perspective, he has been a spokesperson for the post-apocalyptic novel by Owen Hubbard, Battlefield Earth, on several radio shows. Welcome, Mike.
Hi. Good to be here.
So we're going to be going over various aspects of your career, and I'm also interested in discussing how, you know, the how-to of writing military science fiction and military fiction itself, and also discuss libertarian-themed science fiction. So, first of all, how did you originally get started as an author?
I actually started writing when I was about 8. I was writing a book about rockets based on other books I'd read about rockets. And then I started writing science fiction in junior high school. A friend of mine got me interested in Heinlein's Juveniles. I read all of those the library had. And Ms. Kashak, the librarian, showed me some stuff by Lester Del Rey, White, several others. I read bunches of it, and I started writing. The stuff I was writing back then was very derivative, and I did some more in high school. I actually had a very good hit rate on letters to the editor, though. I knew I had some kind of ability there, because if I sent a letter in, it got published. And then I'd had another round of something that I looted some bits of it for Freehold later, but I did that when I was active duty in the Air Force and sent that to Analog, who rejected it because, well, it really wasn't their type of thing and it wasn't that good, be honest.
But otherwise, it was for sure.
you got to start somewhere. It's yes. All practice. And I eventually looted a couple of characters from that and a couple of ideas and incorporated them into other stories. From there, I was writing technical articles for a couple of disaster preparedness websites, a few other things, and getting paid for some of it. And I was hanging out on Bain's forum, and I complained about all these rejection letters I was getting from the magazines, and they all had, alas, it does not suit our needs at this time. Stop with the poetry. You just say, dear contributor, thanks, but no thanks. And Jim Bain responded to me with, well, maybe they're being, alliterative. Alack, alas, allay. That said, send me one single chapter of something you're working on and I'll take a look at it. And then he said, okay, send me another chapter. Send me another chapter. Just send me the rest of the manuscript. Well, I really don't like that. This is too long and wordy here. That's got to be fixed. Fix that. Okay, let's just call it a deal. I'll buy the book. I think they had two new authors that year. Tom Kratman was one of them. I was the other. And I've had a pretty good success rate. Occasionally they'll say, no, that doesn't really interest us, but can you do something else? And I'll give them another idea and they'll say, go with it. And I've had short stories published with Daw in Mercedes Lackey's universes, a couple other publishers, and Bill Fawcett packaged a military sniper trilogy, contemporary fiction, for me with HarperCollins. I just got the rights to those back, and so I'm putting those out electronically.
Well, good. So that leads, because a lot of the stuff you're talking about now seems to be military tinged, and I know you've got, a 25-year stint with the military?
Yeah, I was active Air Force, Army Guard, Air National Guard, Army National Guard again, Air National Guard again. Anytime someone had a slot I could promote into, I changed units.
So how does a military career fit in with your writing? Has that been an inspiration for your writing, or is that just something that since you're 8 years old writing your first story that...
There's so much to use for writing from any experience in the military, because you have all the bureaucracy of the government, all the stupidity of the bureaucracy, and then the military sometimes takes it to new heights because of there's some really good stuff too. I mean, I had some great experiences. I worked with some brilliant people, but there's other times you're all just staring at each other going, how did this happen? Yeah. The thing I notice between writers who are veterans and writers who aren't is if they're not veterans, the stuff is too clean. Tom Clancy's writing was fascinating and lots of fun. but nothing works that reliably in the real world. We had one time, it was 30 below zero, so we were using a Hummer to keep warm at the entry control point. And someone had taped a sign on that says, "Do not shut the engine off. The starter's bad." So naturally, at some point, somebody shut the engine off. And we couldn't get it started again. Like, it was right there. You know, the vehicle's not moving. And this is taped in front of the driver's seat. And someone turned it on. You know, just stupid stuff. Stuff just stops working for no reason whatsoever. You know, roll the dice and, you know, there's a critical miss.
That kind of stuff, I think, probably happens. That's not just reserved for the military, those types of stupidity.
Yeah. Right. But people, a lot of times people who are writing military stuff, well, oh, and this works and this works. And it's like, well, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Trying to make it the where it's just the best possible scenarios that can come off for the hero. And if it doesn't, it's because it's the second try fail fair cycle. But then at the very end, then everything comes off just fine.
Well, yeah, hopefully the hero does make it work anyway. But, you know, there can be all kinds of issues on the way at every kind of level.
So any particular parts of your military career that like directly affected any of your stories or that you've written, or is it just as a general concept?
A lot of stuff has shown up in the two Freehold anthologies. One's out and one's coming out in June. I was an engineer on the Air Force side, airbase engineer and a mechanical section chief. And then on the Army side, I did the forward support elements for infantry units, which is a lot of fixing stuff. And one of the things engineers are also trained in is how to break stuff. Because if you can't take something with you, you want to make sure no one else can use it. And they didn't let us actually practice very often, but training includes blowing things up, setting them on fire, doing nasty mechanical things to them, leaving them in convenient places like in the middle of the runway, blocking doors, soaking things with water, anything you can do to hinder access. I learned how to recon for mines, and there's some really devious and nasty mines out there. People think of a mine, you step on it and it blows up. There's mines that will come hunt you down. There's mines that look like trees, and they just count the number of troops brushing through the area. And then eventually they blow up. Some have time delays. There's all kinds of... I haven't been told I can talk about it. It's probably declassed after this long, but they've never told me I can talk about it. But there's all kinds of technical innovations in ways to kill people. We fixed a lot of equipment. We dug a lot of holes. And all of this is very useful for slowing people down. There's a World War II incident that we recycled for one of these stories. Someone left dinner plates all over the road. And a couple of them had mines underneath them. The rest of them didn't. But once you realize that that's a potential threat, you have to stop your convoy and check every single obstacle in case it is a mine.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Just when you're in the military, were you actually writing at that time when you were deployed, or did you?
I actually wrote.
You got back and then.
No, I started writing my first active duty tour, and that stuff didn't get published. I was in the Guard and I was getting published, and all my bios say I'm a veteran. They didn't say I was actively serving because that can color things. And then I actually wrote most of Contact with Chaos, my first contact novel, while I was deployed. Kept me sane, 12 hours in the scorching desert sun, listening to stuff happening and trying to duct tape stuff together, and then back to the billet I had and tap, 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 tap.
Yeah.
I had the Olympics and a novel to write.
See, part of this too that I'm really interested in is for anybody who's like an aspiring writer, how to be able to take what you're saying, because you're talking about the types of military fiction, the difference between somebody who's actually served and not, where the person that hasn't served, is there some type of trick or some type of a tool or aspect they need to review or something they should read, or what is it to make sure that what they're saying is actually believable, for someone who's actually been in the military?
So if you're doing military fiction and you haven't been in the military, Timothy Zahn's a good model because he was never in the military. He was a college student and became successful as a writer, physics. I believe, in astronomy. Mm-hmm. And he does some really good stuff, and he based it on his experience with the college bureaucracy. Same thing. you've got to fight your own system. You've got to get your own authorizations, and then you've got to deal with the enemy as well. So there's any kind of a background approach to from your day job. How well does somebody's day job actually match the official job description? Usually not very closely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, that makes sense. So then, as part of your career in the military, do you use characters? Do characters evolve from that, or is that characters just straight out of your own mind? Or
characters are usually a composite. I'll pick a couple of traits or an attitude from somebody I know, possibly military, possibly not. I'll adapt it from there. I might merge a couple of different attributes from other people. Because every character should have strengths, weaknesses, and has depth to them. But by all means, if you've met somebody who's a distinctive character, they can be the basis for a fictional character. But you shouldn't model them too closely unless you're actually doing a bio.
Right. Right. Yeah,
you might make them your own. Add some flaws. And if you're doing it right, even if you don't like the character, you'll come to understand their perspective. Why is this character acting like this? Well, they feel this way. I mean, I don't, but that's what they are.
Right. So now your fiction that you write, your military fiction, especially The Freehold, as you say, it's libertarian themed. So let's discuss that a little bit. First of all, define and describe what libertarianism is, or what a libertarian is, and maybe from when it was first conceived and how it's evolved now 40 some odd years later.
Yeah, 20 years later.
20.
I started writing that in 98, and it was sold in 2002 and published in 2004. So yeah, a little over 20 years.
But the libertarianism itself was conceived, I think, 20 years before that.
Yeah, I was ruined long before that. if you have five libertarians, you'll have six different positions on what libertarianism is. I was just exploring the concept. If you're going to have an off-world colony developing, they're probably not going to have a huge amount of time to start with for bureaucracy, administration, things like that, much like the U.S. did. You're dealing with the nuts and bolts of staying alive, building infrastructure, and then you can worry about having a government to manage it all. And I extrapolated from there, if you decided to keep the government as minimal as possible, there's advantages, there's disadvantages. So, who plows the roads? If you don't have a government entity who's plowing the roads in winter, who does it? Who builds the roads? And some of these things, as technology progresses, there's workarounds. Sometimes there isn't. And then you have to decide whether you're going to go with that or not. And we live fairly rural here, and one of the ongoing things is people who are moving out of the city into the neighborhoods that are being built around here. And well, it's so quiet and peaceful out here in the country, but there's all this noisy equipment and occasional gunfire. And it's like, yeah, you're in the country. There's farming going on, and people shoot on their property. Sometimes it's pest control. Sometimes they're just shooting for fun. That's what you get when you move out here. But we wanted the peace and quiet of the country. Like, well. Yeah. So, there's a ongoing, urban versus rural development that happened in the U.S., happens in a lot of the colonial countries. And in this case, they started with that and they decided to keep the infrastructure, the government infrastructure minimal. And I just explored where that would go.
Mm-hmm. So, I always find it interesting because you've got such an extensive military career and then libertarian, so.
Yeah, that was often a problem, yeah. Although there's quite a few libertarians and anarcho-capitalists in the military. And then sometimes there's friendly social disputes because often very conservative religious people, and then there's a handful of, pagans, there's a handful of atheists, agnostics, and there's a lot of intense but friendly discussions on philosophy when there's nothing else to do.
I'm sure. Yeah, you can.
Some of them were very enlightening. It was fascinating.
Yeah. All right. So now with libertarianism. So how does that, how is it received, or how is it like fit in with today's society? And because you're continuing to write books with this concept of, you know, this laissez-faire government, which is kind of like the opposite of what's happening. So I'm not trying to go into a government discussion here, but a political discussion here, but
it seems to be a normal evolution of any society that it becomes more and more entrenched with bureaucracy, particularly, and government generally as time goes on, until eventually there's either some kind of collapse or some kind of reset. And people generally don't want to be beset with troubles or problems, so they want something else to take care of those problems for them. But then the issue is, can a government respond fast enough, and can it even fix the problem? You know, frequently, there's things they can't fix, but people want it fixed anyway.
So being then a libertarian and writing your libertarian themed stories, what type of a readership do you have? Is it just like people just like good science fiction, they like military fiction,
so
they're just a different view on it?
Yeah, I have readers all the way across the political spectrum. One of the best compliments I got was a woman who walked up to my table at a convention and said, "I despised the politics and I couldn't put it down." Like, well, then I did my job.
So exactly.
They liked the story enough that they.
Yeah. On your Freehold series, because how many books are with that now? This is, you've got your second one coming out?
The anthology is a second anthology coming out, although I did an anthology before that goes through the universe. I mean, it is Freehold related. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 novels. I'd have to count.
And this is all published with Bain?
Yes.
Good. Yeah. I've had several authors with Bain on this podcast.
Yeah. They're very professional to work with. If they ask for fixes, it's because they see a issue in the flow and pacing of the story. They've got Eric Flint, who is a Trotskyite, that one end of the spectrum. They've got Tom Kratman at the other end of the spectrum, and then they've got a couple of us floating off to the side going, so what's this government thing?
Yeah, I had Toni Weisskopf on as a guest back in December.
Yeah, I love working with her. She's great.
Yeah, she really is great. And it was amazing when she told me that she was actually at one of the Rise of Future events when we were in New York. This is when she was a young pup, in publishing, and she helped cut the cheese and serve refreshments, at that.
She's been in the field since she was 22, I think.
Yeah. And she's just
30 years. Yeah.
Yeah. And she just, under Jim, just kind of like growing and learning all the different hats and jobs and activities there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so more power to her on that for sure. Mm-hmm. So now when we spoke, when we were working together on you helping to publicize the Battle for the Earth campaign, I kind of viewed you as, like I said, a survivalist. And I mean, if right now we're just talking, if people had a chance to hear about your arsenal and all the stuff that you keep there, and how you use the money that I was paying you for doing the radio interviews. So tell me about just being a survivalist in general, then we'll get into how that ties in with your fiction.
So every time one of these terms comes up, it rapidly gets corrupted by sensationalist media. It was the survival movement in the 80s. And there was a handful of fringe nut jobs, some of whom are still around. And, the survivalists want a revolution. And they're like, well, no. And then it became, the prepper movement and the same allegations. Yeah, and any movement has idiots and nut jobs attached to it. It's impossible to avoid. One of the ones I brought up was that 2 years ago now here, in the space of 10 days, we had a tornado knock down one of the trees, a flash flood that flooded this room I'm sitting in now, and we're on a hill. We live on the side of a hill. And we had a lightning strike that took out some of the electronics and did long-term damage to my computer, which I finally just replaced, knocked everything offline for several hours. In 10 days, bang, 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 three natural disasters. And then, as we noticed just about a year ago now, everyone was frantically hunting for toilet paper in the stores. Yes. We buy it. We get a 60-roll crate delivered on schedule. My wife handles all that, sanitary supplies, diapers, everything. So we went to the store just to do our routine shopping of a couple of items, and it's like, holy cow, what happened here? It's like the locusts came through.
Exactly.
And, how are you guys doing for supplies? It's like, fine. Yeah, we've got our own well. We've got bottled water. We've got a septic system. We've got three freezers full of food, MREs, dry goods, pantry full of cans. We just keep this stuff on hand routinely because things like this happen. We had a snowstorm here a few weeks ago that, we're only stuck for like 3 days. But we're on a tertiary road, really. We're next to near a state highway, but by the time they plow here, it's been a day or two.
Right.
So it's just an attitude and a mindset of, so what can I easily do? And you don't need a huge budget for it. You buy a few cans here, a few cans there. Make sure you have firewood if you have a fireplace. I insist on a fireplace in the house. That's one of my, several years ago, the furnace went out. And between the stove in the kitchen, the fireplace downstairs, we kept the house at 70 degrees in sub-freezing weather for about 4 days until they could come out and replace it. It's all just mindset, not freaking out, not waiting for a revolution, although if it happens, I did one presentation. It was a list of potential threats, and all the way up to the Yellowstone caldera exploding and nearby supernova. And when you get to there's nothing you can do. So you don't worry about those.
Right.
But
Yeah, so on being a survivalist then, because that's why I was wanted to talk to you about it, because there are the, like I said, the exposés, quote unquote, done by the media to make it seem like it's just, like I said, the whack jobs. But survivalism is actually a very sane approach to life.
Sure. Yeah. Make sure you're not living day to day. You've got to have some kind of buffer. Just like you have savings of money, you need savings of food, clothing. And you brought up the gun collection. I do have an extensive collection, and my wife got me into collecting classic shotguns from 100 years ago or so, all of which are handmade, beautifully engraved. And
they're beautiful. They're beautiful weapons.
Yeah, and then I like modern tactical stuff. I've handled it a lot in the military, and I've done some research and development. I've done beta tests for manufacturers because I was a competitive shooter in the Army. And you need some means of defending your stash in an emergency, defending the house if there's an attack. And out here, I've had to put down predators who were eating our chickens. We lost 35 chickens 1 week. And I shot two raccoons and the possum, and that stopped. We occasionally get coyotes, but they haven't been able to get through the fence to the animals.
Right.
Guns are certainly part of the equation, but they're not the only part of the equation. Although one of the magazines pointed out in the 80s that they sold best when they had a gun on the cover. Your books and magazines will sell if there's a hot chick or a weapon on the cover. That's just the way people are.
Or a hot car too, hot car, or maybe all three.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Actually, on MeWe, there's a thread that's it's women, guns, and cars is the theme of the group.
Yeah. So on, on writing libertarian fiction, any particular, or actually any type of political philosophy with respect to writing fiction, is there anything that you found that, because you've got the libertarian, but then you've also have the left and the right as well. Mm-hmm. Is it viewed that way, first of all? Where libertarian's more central?
Well, Dr. Purnell came up with the two axes of economic and social liberties versus state control. That seems to be more accurate. And and I'm all the way down in the corner and outside going, you stated. But left and right, when they originally developed, was during the French Revolution. And the left was the workers, and the right was the landowners and the nobility. And that's not truly accurate anymore, but the terms get used. So, and libertarians get accused of being everything. I get accused of being a socialist, which is ridiculous. People love to make Mussolini comments about libertarians. It's like, so fascism is kind of the exact opposite of libertarianism.
Yeah.
And me being an anarcho-capitalist, it's like fascists support a strong central government. We don't. there's a lot of angry people out there who are outraged that you don't like their particular form of government. And it's like, well, you know, there's a variety of governments on the planet. There's a variety of governments in the states. Find one you like. Yeah.
Yeah. When Elron Hubbard wrote the book Final Blackout, have you read that one?
Yeah, that's I've read big chunks of it. Yeah, that's disturbingly prophetic and
it was interesting how the socialists called him a fascist, and a fascist called him a communist for writing that. And
how dare we object to our war?
That category more of. And it was reviewed as like one of the most incredible anti-war stories ever written.
It really showed. Yeah.
So I don't know that it would have been considered libertarianism, but it was definitely survivalist. And he was very much the lieutenant who's the only, he doesn't have a name. He's just a lieutenant is the one that survives. And he helps the only form of government he has is him making sure that his troop survives.
Right.
As they get through war-torn Europe at the time. Mm-hmm. And any military hierarchy was shown to be, as you were describing, very futile with a lot of the weird bureaucracy that was bureaucracy for the sake of bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. So on, like I said, this is, because this, we're talking about writers of the future here, we've got the aspiring writers, and it was originally created by Mr. Hubbard to provide that means to help the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. So for an aspiring writer and getting into and writing either speculative fiction or even more specific yourself, military fiction, the libertarian fiction, what are some of the do's and don'ts?
So you need to, write something and make sure you finish it. And have some kind of plot concept of what you're doing. In my case, I write an ending first. I may change the ending, but it gives me a destination to go to when I'm writing, so I don't just ramble on for pages. I know people who write very detailed outlines and then work their way through. I tend to hit high points and then blend things together, which wouldn't have been possible before the word processor, but you have to have some kind of plan on what you're writing and why. Write it, get it completed, and figure out what the market is. Which publisher are you sending this to? I mean, there's some oddball ones out there, like Dune got published by, I believe, Peterson Publications, who normally does car manuals. I'm not sure how that came about, but if it's young adults, there's publishers who specialize in that. If it's technical military fiction, for short stories, if it's highly technical, Analog is the place to start.
Or writers of the future.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
There's always anthologies out there who are looking for talent. And write something, get it finished, figure out who the market is, send it there. And if it doesn't work there, send it somewhere else. And then in the meantime, be working on the next story. It's an ongoing learning process. Everything you write, you learn from, and just keep going. There's a certain amount of luck. There's some people who are never going to get published just from pure luck, but there's also people who don't get published because they're not very good. It's not everybody's forte. But if you have talent, and if you work on the talent, because you have to, the talent's no good if you don't put the effort in. There's a respectable probability that someone will go, hey, this is good. And then you get published.
Okay, good. So on your bio, it goes into how that you've consulted on military matters, weapons, and disaster preparedness for Discovery Channel and Outdoor Channel Productions, and you're editor at large for Survival Blog. So Does your having written help on that, or does that help your writing? Or is it just two separate channels for you?
Outdoor Channel invited me for the Best Defense show, and that was on Bugging Out. And then the Discovery Channel gig was kind of hilarious. Charles Gannon, who writes for Bain, also does a lot of script consulting.
Yeah.
And the show was talking to him, and he recommended me for both strategic consult and for, I loaned them like 100 weapons, right? I took 100 weapons down for filming. And then they called Jim Rawls at Survival Blog and asked, you know, and he said, well, the expert on this would be Michael Williamson, our editor at large, who also writes sci-fi. And then 5 minutes later, they called back in. So apparently you're the guy to go to for this. It's like, well, I'm one of the guys to go to for this. I mean, there are others. But it was a lot of fun. Outdoor Channel paid well. Discovery Channel paid. So the writing led to that. But for these days, the way media is, you know, being able to put on your bio that you worked on a TV show. It's like, oh, you worked on a TV show. Well, yeah, I've also got 9 best-selling novels and, you know, 40 or 50 other stories in, you know, 3 languages. Yeah, but you were on a TV show. So, especially with the younger crowd. So.
Yeah.
That's, TV is the be all and end all.
Yes. Now, is it because of that you now test and review firearms and gear for manufacturers?
I was already doing that. And I need to get back into that. I was doing it fairly consistently for a while. I got sent flashlights, backpacks, emergency rations, compasses, all kinds of stuff like that. I avoided the electronics because I can use them, but I'm not, even though I've got training in electronics, I'm the wrong person to be handing gadgets to. Yes, I shot competitively in the Army, so I'm pretty good with checking over a rifle for, you know, accuracy, reliability, ease of operation, and maintenance. And so people would, and now those you have to send back. You know, $1,500 rifles, $2,000 rifles aren't gifts. But, you know, the flashlights you usually get to keep, the rifle not so much.
You get a room full of flashlights and spent shells.
Actually, I did wind up with quite, you know, over 20 years, they've all eventually worn out, but I wound up with some good gear, and I would do long-term, you know, follow-ups. Hey, I've had this thing in use for 4 years now, and it's still working. And if they were still in business, that was, you know, good marketing for them.
For sure. So now you were originally born in England, raised in Liverpool, mm-hmm. and then Toronto, Canada, and then now you're in Indianapolis. So mm-hmm. has the various, I guess, mentalities or political philosophies of England versus Canada and the United States, has that affected or has that enhanced your
absolutely
view?
Yeah.
How so is that?
So my father's Scottish. My father's Scottish. My mother's English. I was born Birkenhead near Liverpool. And then I was 7 when we moved to Mississauga near Toronto. And my father worked for TransCanada Pipelines there. He'd worked for Pilkington Fiberglass. And then he got a job with Owens Corning in the U.S. I was 11. And I literally changed continents. It's like, pack up everything you know. Say goodbye to everybody you know. You're never going to see them again. So that was an interesting break. The biggest thing I noticed when we got to Canada, which isn't the U.S., but has some similarities with the U.S. You know, we got to Canada, and I'm in a car where my feet don't hang over the seat, and there's a radio in the car, and there's air conditioning in the car, and there's power windows in the car. And this is not something that was common in the U.K. at the time. And then we went to a grocery store where there's just hundreds of feet of produce and fresh meat, and you can just help yourself. You don't have to haggle over it. And they'll load it into the car for you. And it was just a complete change. It's like, wow. Yeah. It was amazing. And the weather, because the UK is rainy much of the year. Uh-huh. And not as warm. And, Toronto, same temperature ranges, same climate as I'm in here. Sometimes it breaks 100 degrees. And then in the winter, it can be 30 below. Both of which were way beyond anything I'd experienced in the UK. In Canada, like most people, we were apartment dwellers. There's so many people in the Southern Peninsula near Toronto. Almost everyone lives in apartments. And, the apartment was three bedrooms, two baths. We had a squash court and swimming pool and underground parking and outdoor tennis courts. And, you know, it was nice, you know, a nice apartment living.
Yeah.
And walked to school and then, you know, got to the U.S. And one of the things I remember getting to the U.S. was the blizzard of 78. And I went walking into school and everything's quiet and snowy. And I knocked on the door and janitor came by and opened the door. And I said, school? And he says, oh, it's closed because of the blizzard. It's January. Because I just moved down from Toronto where they had lake effect snow. I was like, it's January. It snows in January. Why would you close the school over snow? So, and we get snow in Ohio, you know, but it was just more than they were used to. So, you know, things like that, you know, greatly color my perception.
Yeah. So now you've got how many best-selling novels?
So I've got two Locus bestsellers and at least seven Wall Street Journal bestsellers.
So they all the because when you talk about you're all over the spectrum on what you like to write. You know that you've got your fiction,
those are all sci-fi.
Got,
mm-hmm.
Those are all sci-fi. Yep. Okay. So do you prefer writing science fiction? Obviously, that seems to be your survival forte.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, the Freehold universe, you know, there's a war going on. There's politics. There's militaries. And, you know, like in our worlds, they're all hamstrung by existing budgets, operating guidelines, laws, you know, et cetera. If you're writing honestly, the ammo's not unlimited like it is in a game. You can't just shoot things at random. Yeah. There's rules of engagement. There's, you know, entire operating principles of how you do this. And partway through, I said, you know what, this is, I want to do something, you know, more casual. So the Ripple Creek trilogy, and I'm eventually doing a fourth one that's in the Freehold universe, but elsewhere in the timeline. And they're future high-tech bodyguards. And so I had them get cut off from support. They've got the principal they're protecting, and they need to extract and evacuate him to safety. Mm-hmm. So they just get to blow up whatever they want and spend money and shoot things. And it was it was refreshing change from him. So what's, you know, what's the budget and the operating? There's no budget or operating guidelines. Blow something up.
Yeah.
And yeah, more movie like, you know, more fun.
Hmm. Now, how familiar are you with Writers of the Future?
I've read quite a few of the anthologies, actually, way back, not recently. I haven't had time to read anything fiction-wise recently. Mm-hmm. And no, it's you've developed some really good writers, and yeah, the concept's great. And I've tried to emulate that. I brought several new writers into my anthologies, and you know, people I'd interacted with, and it's like, you know, so you know, let's see how your writing voice is, give me a sample. Well, looks good. Okay. Well, let's, you know, develop a story. You know, we need new writers. You know, the old ones get repetitive and eventually stop for one reason or another.
Yes.
And there's always new things to write about and, you know, new writing styles.
Yeah. That's one thing we've definitely found with Writers of the Future. And I'm always amazed with it, how the, writers come with such fresh new ideas, and you're just kind of like, mm-hmm. How do they think of that? You know, it's just, I'm fascinated because we're now ready to publish volume 37.
Wow, it's been that long. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's always so many different story ideas, both in fantasy and science fiction, or mm-hmm. Sometimes we do a little bit of dark fantasy, but we keep it so it's pretty much all PG so that
right.
Junior high and up can read it and stuff. But yeah, that's something I want to make sure that people understand, that these books contain some of the, they are the best of the best. This is the, it's an amazing field of aspiring writers that submit, and what the judges get is just the story and a number. They have no idea if it's male, female, age,
right.
Nationality, anything. And we just recently started when if a person is writing from England and they use UK English, that's what gets published. You know, if it's Canadian or Australian or United States. So that started last year in volume 36. And so you've got three different versions of English.
Yeah, I have a story about that. The second Ripple Creek novel, some of the characters are Welsh. And the principal they're protecting and the family are Welsh. So I have two different stories about this. So I went through, and everything from their POV was done in British spelling, British rhetoric, British mannerisms. So, you know, O-U-R instead of O-R, things like that. And I got to Bane, and Tony made the executive decision that the dialogue would stay that way, but she wanted all the rest of it to be an American standard for ease of publication. It's like, okay, fine, you know, that's the reality we're facing, then sure, let's do that. And then when it got to the printer, they helpfully corrected everything to American standard.
It's like, everything?
Yeah. So why are my Brits speaking like Americans?
I know.
And then my now ex-wife and I did several stories for Mercedes Lackey and in the Elemental Masters universe, which is set in Britain in the early 20th century. So I just switched over and did everything in British dialect. And I'd send her what I was working on and she'd fix it. It's like, no, we're doing it in British. We got that worked out. And we send the story in and they said, it's really good, but the whole universe has been published in American standards. And that's what we're doing. It's like,
Oh, that worked.
I'm delighted to hear you're keeping it in the, in the format it's written.
Yeah.
And that affects how you read it.
Yeah, it does.
It colors it.
Yeah. Then you know that that's what it is. It just helps you to actually enter that into that universe.
And especially when you start seeing colloquialisms that are, you know, not American. If the writing style isn't American as well, it flows better than suddenly having this jarring, where did that come from?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's just, we found it was good on that. And it's also, it adds to the global appeal of Writers of the Future. Mm-hmm. And we now also have the illustrators, which is, I think I'm fascinated with, because now, because we have so many more entries in the illustrator contest, we have in the last volume, we had one of the winners from Vietnam, and it's a different art form than a winner we had from Iran, which is a totally different art form, than the person we had from Turkey, which is a different art form. Then we had UK, we had US, and we've got a winner this year from Portugal. So they all have different, you know, basic art styles. So we have them all right now featured. And it makes such an amazing, I think, better presentation, representation of art in general. So we're not trying to say, let's make it the, you know, the Gothic American standard, whatever it's going to be in terms of art. It's just all these different styles of art. And they're just the colors that are used from Mexico versus Vietnam versus Iran. I said, it's amazing seeing that. And we've got that now as part of the book as well with Writers of the Future, which people are really into art can find stuff they won't otherwise see anywhere.
Right. Yeah. I've seen some amazing art on some of the forums and sites. There's some very, very talented, both photographers and painters and, you know, computer artists out there.
Yeah. And that's part of what we're trying to do now with this podcast, because we have, each episode is listened to, it goes to about 100 different countries. And so try to make it so it appeals to as many people as possible, and to have it so that, you know, pearls of wisdom that you're able to drop, you know, in this interview can be used by writers anywhere, or some aspect of it they can learn to be able to better polish their writing or to open up a new aspect to their writing. So how has your evolution gone from when you first started, besides the fact that you were just copying what you read elsewhere, to becoming like the type of writer that you are now?
I read a lot of nonfiction that gets me background for stuff, you know, both historically and developmentally. I mean, I've certainly improved dramatically as a writer, and I've started using more points of view in a story. You know, rather than just one or two, and we got somewhere, you know, there's multiple characters and multiple interactions. And I've had to pay attention to having, you know, the characters interact with each other, not just having this couple and these two people over here. And, you know, definitely more depth and subplot, you know, because each character has their own development. Each relationship between any two characters has its own development. And, you know, then the, you know, there's the environment and the conflict and any sub-conflict, and then, the difference between, say, a villain or a problem if it's man versus nature, versus a foil who isn't necessarily hostile, but is, an obstruction. I've learned a lot about this type of stuff and how to make the writing much thicker and richer.
So do you read a lot to be able to help you see how the people do stuff, as mm-hmm. well as just yourself getting more experience just because a writer writes, and so as you write, you get better and better?
Well, I like reading, and I wish I had more time for fiction, but I read lots and lots of relevant nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing the second time travel novel that's set in Paleolithic Central Asia, so I've been reading a lot of technical development, Stone Age, some Bronze Age, even though that's further ahead than where I'm writing, just to see how the development went. Linguistics.
So for your research is a big part of what you do for your science fiction.
Yeah.
So to put together one of your science fiction novels off world. Mm-hmm. So what type of stuff would you normally research, or have you researched, which adds to your bullpen to make that as realistic, as plausible as you can? What type of research do you do?
So for star systems, astronomy, physics, options for biology and geology, then those will all affect what the climate is going to be. And that's as far as the technical background. And most of that's not actually visible to the readers. Very occasionally, I had someone say, so the climate you describe for Grenya and the Freehold universe is actually how the climate would be on a planet like that. Like, yeah, I know. I did that on purpose. Like, you actually researched that? Like, yeah, I've got a friend who's works at Air Force Global Weather Central, who's a forecaster and meteorologist. And I consulted with him and a couple of climatologists and put that together. And, yeah. But, that's the background there. And then the environment will color the culture to some degree, and so will distance, resources. If you've got lots of resources, you have lots of free time to devote to other pursuits. If you don't, it's hand-to-mouth existence.
Right.
And then as I became relevant for the alien invasion for Discovery Channel, geography matters. Cities are typically near coasts or major waterways because they had to be, both to get material goods in and to get waste out. You can't have huge cities in the middle of the plain, like here in Indianapolis, without modern technology. Trucks and rail make this possible. Without that, we're on a really minor secondary river, and this would be a little settlement, not a major city. Chicago would still be huge because it's right on the lake and on a river.
Okay, so so you do a lot of study, and I've had it happen with several interviews with several judges and just other writers themselves who they didn't get it right. Larry Niven talks about it mm-hmm. on his Ring World.
He got that beginning is two things wrong, but they weren't immediately visible to most readers. He had
people that was visible to talked about it.
Yeah, he had the character going the wrong way around the world through transfer booths. And then for the Ring World, it's one, unstable without attitude jets to maintain its position because a solar flare could push it offline. And two, the slowly moving shadow squares would lead to way too much twilight. So those actually have to be spinning retrograde, so the twilight is shorter and the daylight longer. But I mean, for his first pass was absolutely amazing. Yeah, even if there were flaws in it.
Yeah, but he definitely had his fans that pointed it out. So he pointed out it's important to do your homework on it. If you're going to pass muster with the guys that really know that, at least that general subject, you need to do your homework.
There's been several times I've read something and gone, so that's not how you do a parachute jump. you should have just had them jump and had them on the ground and skipped everything in between, because you got that wrong.
Yeah. Well, I saw a commercial once where they were jumping out, so
yeah,
that's what it seemed like. Yeah, that,
watching the wingsuit videos and that was a sport that wasn't allowed for a long time, and man, that's insane. It looks like fun. It also looks like it's insane.
What was that?
The wingsuiting, where they're
the
suit's basically a glider, and they're going largely in Switzerland, going down the sides of mountains a few feet off the the landscape. And there's even one video where you see the guy underneath him slap into the ground and died. I was like, yeah, that's you realize that guy just died, right? I mean, this video looks great, but that someone lost their life in this sport just now.
Yeah. So on, I think that the significance of this is that you have to do your homework if you're going to be, and do your research properly, mm-hmm. if you're going to actually be writing credible science fiction. Because right now there are so many people writing good science fiction that what makes something from being good to great, it's going to be being able to actually handle that so that the reviews come in,
yep.
saying, wow, this, he got it right.
And write what you know. You know, if a character can be an observer and a character can be an actor, you know, your character can be management rather than, you know, the operator. You know, there's all kinds of places your character can be. And if one of those is your field of expertise, then use that, because you will bring more depth to it and make it more interesting. I mean, there, you know, there's Hollywood movies about finance, which is not that interesting a subject. But boy, you pick the right character and the right presentation, which, you know, for screen also involves an actor, and you can make a multi-million dollar selling movie about, you know, somebody doing a trade deal. You know, it's, right. it's all in how it's presented. So if you're an expert at managing something or researching something, then make that the story. Yeah, there's been some amazing stories about doing archaeology for alien civilizations, for example. You know, it's entirely possible to, you know, just have somebody digging in the dirt and then extrapolate from what they're finding and pile up the research and be fighting with budget and bureaucracy and developing new ideas.
Exactly. So now you've written all these books, and if someone's not familiar with you, what would you recommend is their primer? The Michael Z. Williamson. And it's Michael Z. Williamson when looking mm-hmm. up when Googling you.
Yep.
What do you recommend as the primer to read for you?
Both my ex-wife and my wife keep throwing Freehold at people. They say that's the And I'm a much better writer now, but I'm proud of it. It sold well. It appeals well. There's good content. I don't reread my old stuff, but I know that I'm significantly better than I was then. But that's the foundation for the rest of the universe. I'm very happy with how A Long Time Until Now, my time travel novel, turned out. It's 10 troops in 2 trucks on a convoy. All of a sudden, there's a bang. They're displaced. They don't know where they are. And eventually they figure out they're in the Paleolithic, and all they've got is what they're carrying and the contents of 2 trucks. And they're going to have to survive with that. And I'm finishing up the sequel now, but I was very, very pleased with how that turned out. It's not in the Freehold universe, but it's
written by Michael Z. Williamson.
And then the first anthology, Freehold Resistance, and I wrote some of it. I wrote all the intervening text, and I've got several other authors. It's really a mosaic novel, because there is a running timeline from the universe going the whole way through from beginning to end. And some of these stories are episodic, and then some of them intersperse. There's 4 stories that intersperse with the others. But I got a bunch of people in dozens of technical fields, IT forensics, neuroscience, an intelligence officer, a pilot, a field artillery officer, combat medic, engineer, me, a couple of weapons experts, multiple bestsellers, multiple academy graduates, several officers, several enlisted, and some of these people have multiple hats, a former SEAL officer. And I assigned some stories. Some of them proposed some stories. And, you know, it's an insurgency. It starts off with our military has just been bombed. Our cities have been occupied. What do we do? And it ends up with the invaders going, so they've got standardized weapons and equipment, an intelligence network, command and control. How did they do this? While the while the invaded peoples are turning the tables on them, and so you don't have to read any of the novels for it to make sense, because it's got the timeline fed into it as to the events that happen. And I didn't write a lot of it, so I can actually read that one. So, but there's some
that was called what was that called again?
And, some new authors, and Freehold Resistance.
Okay, good. And if someone wants to find you, how do they find you on the either social or on internet?
MichaelZWilliamson.com goes to my website. My hobby is at sharppointythings.com, which is making, selling, and knives. The custom stuff's on there. I do some commercial stuff, but that's all the custom stuff. I don't do Twitter. My Facebook wall is a chaotic mess of people fighting each other. So the website's good. It links to my blog.
Okay, good. So MichaelZWilliamson.com.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Michael. Uh-huh. And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We've also been syndicated on the United Public Radio Network, where you can find these podcasts as well. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by Elrond Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you very much for having me.